anything we were talking about earlier. This is the lowest value stocks have been.
Yeah.
And that sounds a little... Value stocks are low-priced stocks where when you take a look at the price of the of the shares outstanding, what?
It's not necessarily low-priced stock. It's just... You go ahead with that.
When you look at the price of all the shares outstanding and you look at what the company is worth intrinsically by calculating what you think if you were to go buy that company, value stocks, generally speaking, are defined as when the stock price is less than the company sale price would be if somebody were to buy the company.
There's a ratio you can look at in a lot of places, like the Wall Street Journal uses the ratio called the price-to-book ratio.
Right.
You can also use the total equity to the market capitalization ratio.
But the last time value stocks were this relatively cheap was 1975, which was a long time ago. I'm one of the few people in this room who remember that year. There's only a few people in the room to begin with.
Right, that's true. I don't remember that year at all, though I existed. I may have been just out of my mind and with some kind of controlled substance or a baby. I could have been a baby.
There's a lot of discussion going on. Well, maybe the value system is broken and value stocks will forever be low, which incidentally, if you wanted to do some speculation, that's a strong indication that value is about to take off at some point in the next several years.
Right. We have a caller that bravely dares to converse with us on the airwaves on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys. Before they left for the summer recess, Pelosi and Mnuchin came up with a budget deal. I guess the Senate has voted on it. Can you guys kind of go over that? What are your views and what's the long-term implication? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, it all depends. The short-term implication I'll hit first, that is if the Senate doesn't agree to it, and by the way, they haven't yet. They're supposed to vote sometime next week, but the whip in the Senate was still counting votes and wasn't completely sure he was going to get a majority. He thought probably he was going to get a majority. Then the government will shut down sometime before Congress comes back. If they do get it, basically they agreed to spend like a drunken sailor.
Yeah. It's a two-year budget, and they've raised spending by hundreds of billions of dollars over existing caps and allow the government to keep borrowing to cover its debts. So all of that's being combined.
Basically, the conservatives said if you're going to have any domestic spending increases, we have to have major defense spending increases. And the liberals said if you're going to have defense increases, we got to have a lot of domestic increases. And everybody said, fine, you can have all the money you want.
Now, only 65 Republicans voted for this in the House. This is despite the president's endorsement.
Right. So the president and Nancy Pelosi worked this out, which that should go down in the record book someplace. Do we have a caller?
We do.
Okay. We have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. And I know you wasn't there to witness this, but in the embryo state of the government when presidents were running for office and they didn't have the media that they have now, how did they get their word around for the people to trust and vote and, you know, ballots and all this? And I'm just kind of curious all that, how that happened. You have a good day.
That's a good question.
Okay. Thanks for the question. That's a good
one. I think there's a current hypothesis on this that there was no life before cell phones.
Yeah, so nobody existed.
Nobody existed.
It didn't matter.
It's all fake news.
It's all fake news.
Now,
newspapers.
Newspapers and flyers.
Benjamin Franklin was wealthy for one major reason. The reason why he was wealthy wasn't from his inventions, although he did quite well there. It was because he owned a lot of newspapers. And that's you said embryo state. The probably the point that concluded that a revolution would take place in the colonies and that the colonials would win was when the Parliament of England called Ben Franklin in front of them and chastised him thoroughly from every direction when he was pretty much the sole in print media supporter of the crown. So they called him to Parliament. They lambasted him back and forth. He flipped over to being anti-United Kingdom that we should have our own country if this is the way they're going to treat us from a distance. So the print media back then was the major source of news. Flyers were part of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, we had the equivalent of the internet. It was just much slower, and that was it. That's why we have a two-party system, so they would have the money fundamentally to publish a lot of pamphlets. It's called pamphleteering, and that's how the various parties would they would hang out posters. As a matter of fact, when I was a kid, I remember very, very well, whenever there was an election campaign, there were posters all over the place where showing pictures of the person running for something and,
which is,
and why we should right. vote. And say in very succinct terms, it basically a Twitter tweet.
Or less, much less sometimes.
Why we should vote for that person. And people do tend to vote for the person they see most frequently. The newspapers would routinely either endorse or not endorse a candidate. Most major cities, which is, of course, where most of the votes are, had two major newspapers, and typically one of them was Republican and one of them was Democrat. Matter of fact, they used to say that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember the exact name of the newspaper when I was growing up in St. Louis, but it was a something Democrat. And they obviously supported the Democratic Party. And there were other newspapers that supported the Republican Party, and they would basically post their arguments in their editorials. And they probably slant their news a little bit too, although they made a point of trying not to do that. People who read the newspapers generally controlled who got elected, meaning that basically the people who didn't read the newspapers in many cases didn't show up to vote. Things are different today. We are bombarded with information from every direction, some of which is accurate and some of which isn't. But there's nothing new under the sun, as Solomon is reputed to have written. Today, the people who would have read the Post-Democrat, St. Louis Post-Democrat, who would have read that, take the New York Times digitally, and they watch CNN. And the people who would do, I don't remember the name of the Republican newspaper in St. Louis when I was a kid, but the people who would have read that Republican newspaper watch Fox News. So there's really...
Yeah, and we just got a different... and some of them even still read the newspapers. It's like we have more sources of news rather than... It's just, if you go back, I mean, some of the newspapers, for instance, in the UK, there's one called The Telegraph. Why do you think it's called that? Well, that's because how the news was carried.
Well, isn't there one in Temple called The Telegraph?
Telegram. That's the Temple Daily Telegram. So it's this concept. And you know, when I first started radio, so I'm sure it was there when you were in radio, it was called The Wire. News just come across The Wire. And it really was like a telegraph.
When I first was in radio, the way we'd get our news was a teletype, which was and that's how fast each letter, each sound that you hear was a letter being typed on the telegraph, and it was coming across the wire.
Right.
Literally.
This was a difficulty not that long ago after the American women won some kind of great contest of bravery, skill, and daring do. They came back, and people were trying to figure out how to have a ticker tape parade when nobody has ticker tape anymore. And I've heard from that conversation, I have heard more young people ask me what ticker tape was. And ticker tape is just a really thin strip of paper that feeds through the wire or whatever the telegraph service is that's feeding this data that puts in automatically, which is...
Well, it actually reads out. It was a machine, a ticker tape mm-hmm. machine. You can actually read... The symbol of the stock would go, and then the price that the last transaction. And some one of the indicators that something terrible was happening in October on October on Black Friday in 1929 was the ticker tape was running an hour behind. In other words, stocks were being transacted so fast
that the ticker tape couldn't keep up.
So it was running an hour and sometimes more than an hour behind the actual transaction. So your attempt to sell the stock, you'd see the price on the ticker tape.
And Sarah, I think we got a good one on that. And then an hour later, your sale actually hit when it was already plummeted.
Yeah, and so that's not anymore. We have instantaneous reporting in.
Well, they thought they did then too. That was the whole thing about the ticker tape. Is this is instantaneous reporting? Except it's just at the speed of the person entering the data at the other end.
And it, you know, it's that's just things change and then things speed up. But the information disseminates much quicker today, and there's a lot more of it, and it's a lot more confusing than it used to be. It's not the first time this has ever happened, but it does cause polarization. The faster information is disseminated and the less expensive it becomes, the more polarized we tend to get. And the more chaotic society tends to get, which is what we're seeing across the world. That's just that's one of
and we saw this happen
Norse law,
right? With print media when it was first innovated. Before that,
we didn't actually see it happen, but we've read about it.
No, I read and saw in history it happen. I wasn't there for it.
You weren't there for Gutenberg's revolution.
Would have been nice, but no. So this idea that you know data is passing around. If you wanted to get into the deep political debates of the Catholic Church, which was the major power of Europe at the time, you had to actually be part of the mail group. You would have mail delivered to you and you would add to it. It was a very slow process. People were handwriting and the people that got to read your handwriting were just a very relatively few people. Gutenberg came out and we have... lots of evidence. In fact, Martin Luther just wrote up a quick thing that he normally would have just written by hand and stuck up on the posting area, just like you would at any bulletin board. And because he was where he was and there was a press available and Gutenberg said, hey, let's try it out. Instead, we had a schism in the major political party of the era. The only political party of the era in that area was the Catholic Church, and you had a schism there. The Protestants came out. What was it that they were called Protestant? They were protesting about specific things, and those protests were written up in print. The cost of information dropped, and it destabilized a political environment. Come forward to today, instead you have Twitter. Anybody can throw their words out there and possibly sway the public if they have enough people listening or reading. So it's just like I didn't see history. I didn't listen to Twitter. Huh. I'm getting my senses all confused here, I think.
Could be. Although I think you could probably listen to Twitter. I don't know how you do it, though.
The caller prior to the last caller was talking about this budget that was passed by the House. The Senate has not passed it. They're not going to touch it until they come back from their recess.
No, they're supposed to take it up this week, this coming week.
Okay.
They don't go on recess.
Because otherwise the government will not be able to continue to borrow.
Yeah, if they don't pass it, if the Senate does not pass this bill and send it to the president sign it, which he's already indicated he would sign the House version.
But he's indicated bills in the past that he would sign that he's changed his mind. Well, there's a lot of uncertainty.
I don't think he wants to shut the government down and plunge us into a recession about a year out from an election. I think that
And people are saying, you know, what do you mean recession? We had a government shutdown back in December. It was the longest on history and we didn't get a recession. That was at a point where we were still feeling the benefits of the tax cut. Now, there was enough money to go around that people were able to spend it. Corporate spending was still up. Even if it was in stock buybacks, people were able to sell the stock at a great gain because of the stock buyback.
And we still had nearly a 20% drop. Well, actually, intraday, the market was down 20%.
Right. So come forward to today, same situation is going to have a bigger effect. So hopefully those in D.C., I wouldn't say those in the know, but definitely those with the power.
Actually, those in the yes are the ones we're trying to.
They need to do something. I'm not happy with the budget that was passed, but I haven't been happy with a budget that was passed for decades, so it's okay. Well, I'm happy that they passed a budget. I wish that they would get their spending under control.
It's not the budget that's the issue in this case. It is an actual budget they passed. What they did pass was a lifting of the limits through so that we don't hit the debt ceiling again until 2021. It's not coincidental that we bumped it all the way out to 2021, or they bumped it all the way out to 2021. They want to get it on the other side of the election because, very frankly, there's a consensus among the elected officials at the in the federal government that budget ceilings and shutdowns and fights do not make them more popular.
Right. This is classic to me in that this budget, the reason why the Republicans are asking other Republicans to vote for it, the reason why the Democrats are asking other Democrats to vote for it, it is maybe the best real-world, real-time example of the plight of the commons. And this is an area that economists talk about sometimes, and it tends to go over people's heads. In a simple form, if you have shared grazing land with another rancher. You're a rancher, they're a rancher. You've got a certain amount of land, and the rains aren't coming so well, and you realize, hey, we got to take some of the cattle off of this land, or we're going to overgraze it. That's not growing fast enough, and that could have long-term consequences. Well, next year, we may not have any grazing land there. So, but you don't agree with the other rancher. So if one of you takes cattle off the field, the other one's going to put more cattle on. That's a problem because you've got a common land that isn't owned by either side. When we're talking about this particular budget deal, it isn't the budget itself. It's a deal on a budget. There's a lot of bills that go into those kinds of deals. The Democrats are saying, vote for this, look at all the spending we get. The Republicans are saying, vote for this, look, it's increasing spending to the defense. Both of them are getting their choice items, the things that they want to give to their constituents. But it's at the price of future generations. It's not even future generations. This generation, just a few years in the distance. We're talking 10 years out, and there's a lot of the things that we look at 10 years out, chickens are definitely coming home to roost. When we look at the problems with Social Security and Medicare and the civilian retirement plan for the U.S. government, you could go down a whole list of things.
Military retirement,
you know, prescription drug benefit things. All of these things have a tipping point in about 10 years, and we're not talking about it. We're kind of accelerating toward the wall. We haven't touched the brakes yet.
The White House took the position when the tax cuts were being proposed and then enacted, when the bill was signed. Kudlow and others took the position that the tax cuts will energize the economy and make growth occur faster and thereby generate enough taxes to offset the tax cut. Well, so far,
we didn't get that.
We have not seen that happen at all. And we mentioned about this being a grand experiment. The economists across the board were saying, we've tried this before and it didn't work. The deficits just went up. And we're seeing it again. I don't see anybody walking it back. I don't see anybody talking about it anymore. And I think
some people are saying, give it more time. But the problem is that we can see the economy not growing as quickly, which means give it more time and we're going to see more negative, not more positive.
And it's an experiment. Will we survive the experiment? We'll survive the experiment. I'm not sure how it's going to be uncomfortable down the road when we have to pay the price for this. But the fact is, you can't continue to spend more money than is being generated in a business or in a country indefinitely. Now, we can do it for a long time because we happen to be the largest, strongest, most powerful nation on the planet. We're at the top of our game. We're doing some wonderful things. But the problem is the philosophy of the Republican Party, the philosophy of conservatism was we should be, and it's, by the way, every economist, including Milton Friedman, who is the darling of the conservatives, agreed that during times of economic prosperity, and that's where we are right now, we should be paying down the federal debt. We shouldn't be running it up. So we've got an experiment here to see basically President Trump, the majority leader whose name just
McConnell.
McConnell got together and they said, hey, Ryan.
Yeah, and Ryan, and now Pelosi.
they all got together and agreed that, hey, we can borrow as much money as we want to because it doesn't make any difference. And that's a different theory than the academic economists have. And we'll see how well that works out in the long term.
You know,
and we'll pay the price for it if it's a bad idea.
I know some college kids with exactly that frame of mind.
It's called student debt.
Yeah. Oh, not just student debt, and credit card debt and car debt. And debt's good. You never have to pay for it. Well, yeah, you do. You just don't have to pay for it today.
It's, and all of this basically works out pretty well. And this is an interesting, by the way, this is a fascinating theory that's part of modern monetary theory. I was reading up on it.
Well, I'm not, they shouldn't even call it that. They should just call it broken.
The issue is if you can keep interest rates, short-term interest rates, lower than inflation, which they are right now, effectively.
Yeah, yeah.
Or at about the same price of inflation. You don't ever have to pay any real interest on the debt as long as you keep your borrowing short-term. The problem with that philosophy is nobody's really got a handle on why interest rates are as low as they are, and nobody's got a handle on what might cause interest rates to go back up again.
The handle, this is maybe the best way of looking at why interest rates are where they are, is when the real was changed in Brazil. It's gone back to being a basket case again. It's really not a good situation anymore. But about 20 years ago, some American-educated economists from Brazil came back and designed a plan to fix the real. The inflation rate was just – it was hundreds of percent a year. And what they did is they created a fake currency, fake enough that it was real. They required everyone in the country to label the prices on their products, if they're selling them in the store, with two price tags, one in current currency and one in future currency, the future currency of the new real when it comes. And it lasted for about a year and a half, and the future currency didn't fluctuate in value. You had pretty constant prices on it. The current real was fluctuating horribly. It was going way, way up. They had to be replacing the price tags on these grocery store items multiple times a day just to keep up with the inflation. And after a year of this, they replaced the old real with the new real. And the inflation stopped. Now, it did. There weren't major changes at the governmental level or at the banking level. There was simply a change in opinion about what was expected by the general population. And when we look at bank interest rates right now, how do banks make a profit? Well, they generally make a profit by loaning money out and earning the interest on it. Well, if the interest rate is lower than inflation, they're not going to give a loan. And at some point, if interest rates stay below inflation, people will stop giving loans to the United States government. Now, the United States government still looks great on paper and in every other direction. You look at the amount of debt that we have, and yeah, people, it's a lot. But if we weren't gathering huge amounts of debt on top of that, it's manageable. It is understandable. We can get this handled. But we're accelerating the debt now. This is a problem.
There's a couple of points about where we pay for this, and it's now I'm going to get a little esoteric, but it's very practical. Holding interest rates to this low a level, whether or not we're doing it or whether the market is doing it, is very beneficial for the federal government borrowing money.
Yes.
Okay. So, but here's the problem with that holding interest rates to this very, very, very low level. Pension plans fundamentally function off of interest rates. In other words, defined benefit pension plans have what's called a discount rate. And the higher the discount rate, the more the money is worth in the pension plan. In other words, if I say that the discount rate for my pension plan is 8%, which it was in the 1990s, that means I expect the money that's in there and the money coming in to grow at 8% a year. If inflation is running at 3%, there's a 5% spread between the two, which is
where
we were.
Yeah, you get 5% of growth if you've got an 8% return on and 3% inflation.
And 8% in the 1990s was a conservative growth rate. But the problem we're running into at this point is because of the very low interest rates, that generates a huge differential across the board. If my discount rate now is 4%, in other words, if I say because of the very low interest rates, I can only expect, because a lot of what's in a pension plan is bonds.
Yeah.
I can only expect to see 4% growth in my pension plan. That means I have to have not twice as much money, but four times as much money in the plan to cover future pension benefits. And the end result is that across the board, the unionized defined benefit pension plans for the railroads, for automobile industry, you name it.
Peace officers.
You name it across the board, are falling further and further behind being fully funded. It also means that the funding for a lot of public pension plans, including Texas, is falling further and further behind. Now, the pension plans in many cases, and this was an article in the Wall Street Journal, which I think was very well done, the pension plans are continuing to assume what they had in the 1990s because they're looking back 40 years and seeing what the average growth rate in the market has been and said, well, it must be that in the future and we're getting an unusually low growth rate right now, but that's temporary. Well, that's kind of imaginary. And the end result of that is that we are seeing a crisis emerge where, and this is one of those really oddities you want something to be concerned about, a crisis emerged in the pension plans across the board that comes to a head roughly 10 years or less from now. In other words, it's 2019, somewhere around 2029 or a little thereafter, Medicare, Social Security, and virtually every major defined benefit pension plan of any kind hits a fiscal crisis because of two things. Low interest rates and underfunding.
And people living longer.
The people living longer is a factor, but it's nowhere near as big a factor
as the interest rates.
As interest rates and funding. And the end result is we have a lot of curves coming together to create what looks like a major fiscal crisis in the early 2030s, which is no coincidence that it's 100 years after the 1930s when we had a major fiscal crisis.
The issue that we have here is that the political environment is never set up to be looking 10 years out. It's set up to be looking at most 6 years out if they're in the Senate. And presidency's looking 4 years out, possibly 8 years out. But anybody that's in power today is going to have multiple elections between now and then. They're much more concerned about being reelected now than about solving a real fiscal problem. We have very real problems in our pension systems at the national level and down at the state level, kind of across the country. We have real problems with logistics. We have real problems with healthcare. We have real problems with a lot of areas, and we're doing pretty well right now. But the fight, the polarization in Washington about nothing you say is right and everything I say is right, and both parties are holding that right now. You're all wrong and I'm all right. Means that we're having a lot of trouble compromising on any of the really important stuff.
Let me put a caveat in there. The Texas Teachers Retirement Fund, as far as I can tell, is healthy.
That's correct.
But there's an interesting point in the Texas Teachers Retirement Fund. They have consciously said no adjustments for inflation. So the issue is that if the Texas Teachers Retirement Fund is growing at 4% instead of 8% like they planned on in the last century. If it's going to have an average 4% growth into the future, it can cover everything as long as we don't take any inflation into account. That is an unfortunate thing if you're a teacher that's retired and dependent upon that. Fortunately, we have very low inflation right now. But it's one of those things that...
And if you're in the UPS pension plan, the part that isn't already telling you it's failing, then you're in pretty good shape on that side. There's another part of it that is not just going to fail. It's in the process of failing. This is one that actions should be taken on the Texas County and District Retirement System pension plan is going to have major problems at the next market downturn. It may already have major problems, but with next market downturn, it's going to be real, folks. It's underfunded, and the investments are extremely speculative. They're weighted in areas with high risk, and they're trying to make up the difference in the low interest rate by taking on a lot of extra risk. So you've got two ends of the spectrum, the low interest rate risk, and then the extreme far other side of the spectrum of reaching for higher returns, but that means higher risks. There's some dangers there, and I think the Texas legislature needs to take that up.
There's another factor here. If you have a defined benefit retirement plan and with a large organization, it is covered by the Pension Benefit
Guarantee Corporation,
which has never been tested on a large-scale basis. But the trustees have warned that if you look at all the underfunded pensions, and if we, at the next major downturn, probably not in 2020, but at the next recession after that, if they go down, they might be able to cover 40 cents on the dollar, which means that if you were planning on having a pension of $1,000 a month, then they would be able to cover, they would be able to, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation would be able to step in if you have a collapse and cover you for $400 a month. And the difference between living $1,000 a month income and $400 a month income is pretty profound. Why are we saying all this? Collectively, it has been so long since we had the Great Depression where we set these programs up that we no longer consider a major economic downturn a threat. We got through the 2008-2009 debacle because of some extraordinary measures that are now, by the way, illegal. And we have come out of it, and we've done reasonably well, and now the sense of threat has gone away. So what can you do about it? And the answer is fund your defined contribution plan.
That's like a 401k.
401k.
403b.
403b, your 401a, whatever number it gets, the place where there's no guarantee on what comes out on the other end, but there is a clear set of what you can put in. There's a maximum you can put in. Fund that thing well. Have it well balanced and diversified. Those are critical issues. Don't throw everything into high growth. Don't throw everything into conservative, guaranteed. By the way, the guaranteed funds in these things are not insured and are in a major downturn would be very dangerous.
Just take a broad approach. Be diversified. This is kind of across the board. Pay down your debts. Gather your savings. This is something we would say to you at any point. But right now is the point where most people have the ability to do it. And we're often seeing the opposite. And we've got to play some commercials. That was a massive segue there.
It was, well, it's, you know, we got to plan for the future. And that's how this organization gets paid for, is playing commercials.
Yes. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. And we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. You know why I like doing that introduction?
Because you like to say your name?
I like to use my radio voice. See, because when I first started in radio back in 1965, I started in radio in 1965. The normal way of talking was like this. It was just standard. You wouldn't get hired if you didn't talk like this. And I got hired as a radio announcer in 1965.
That's impressive.
And back then, when you spoke on the radio, you spoke in a deep, sonorous tone.
Is it sonorous or sonorous?
I don't know.
It's all about the tone, though.
It's the tone.
Not the pronunciation.
Is it sonorous?
I don't know.
Is it sonorous or sonorous? Tony doesn't know. Okay. Anyway, maybe somebody does know. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. We have about 15 minutes, and if today is July 27th, 2019, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call and join in the conversation about anything to do with economic reality or not reality or whatever. There's still some more things going on out there worth interest, that's of interest. There seems to be, and maybe just it's just maybe we're seeing more reports of them. There seems to be a rise in Ponzi schemes perpetrated in some form of weird security. In other words, if somebody says, look, I'm in this fancy real estate thing that's not traded and it's a super insider secret thing and I'm making 12% a year, I'm making 8% a year, regular's clockwork, I get my checks, you can say with a great deal of confidence that it is illicit. It is someplace where you can put your money in and you're going to lose it. Now, you may not know it for several years that you're going to lose your money, but it'll happen. Even if you get out before it collapses, you'll still lose your money because the bankruptcy trustee will come in and do what's called a clawback.
These often used to be called pyramid schemes, Ponzi schemes. Basically, the idea is somebody says, hey, everybody come join me in this fancy fill-in-the-blank investment scheme. The earliest ones didn't even say they were investments. It's just like the pyramid letters. You send me a dollar and you send this letter out to seven other people, and each of them should send the letter out to seven other people, and each of them should be sending a dollar on, then you'll get lots of money. You'll get the money for the next three levels down, whatever.
Unless it is a tangible investment. By that I mean, if you buy real estate and you can see the real estate because you own it, and you signed the title to the real estate,
and you've got it at the courthouse, you know the title is real.
Right. Unless you are a sophisticated, that's by the way, a sophisticated investor by definition. If you can't find it in Morningstar, you shouldn't invest in it. In other words, if you go to Morningstar.com. And you go to look up the investment that you're supposedly in and it's not there, folks, there's a very high probability it's not there. I hate to use that blunt, because there are investments, there are investment funds, there are venture capital funds that have some degree of liquidity. But if you're highly sophisticated, if you can't find it in Morningstar, then you shouldn't be investing in it unless you are an expert investing.
I think you mean to say if you're not highly sophisticated. You keep saying if you're highly sophisticated, you should find it in Morningstar. And
well, if you're
across there, I think if you're not highly sophisticated, you should be able to find it in Morningstar, or it may not be there.
That's what I meant to say. And the issue is, if you have $100 million and you want to put $5 million in a speculative investment that's not publicly traded, that is not tracked by generally accepted accounting principles and reported on publicly and filed with the SEC, fine, power to you.
Yeah, and you should know the risk you're taking in doing it. You should probably get a better return there too. Otherwise, why are you taking this risk?
But if you're not a very wealthy, sophisticated investor, you should not be in anything that you can't go to Morningstar.com, type in a symbol, and see it. And your statements that you get on it should not come from the person that you're giving the money to.
Yeah.
They should come from a separate custodian.
Some kind of audited, third-party audited facility. So Ponzi schemes are popping up, and they generally pop up in really big economic booms, and they generally don't get really popped up until we have the next recession. So they're out there. The fact that we're finding as many as we are today, the SEC is, every week there's four or five of them that pop up. The fact that we're finding that many means there's probably four or five or 10 times that many that haven't been found, that won't be found until we have a downturn in the economy.
There's a saying on Wall Street, which I'm going to credit to Philip Corre, the guy who founded one of the first mutual funds, the Pioneer Fund. And that is, you never know who's not wearing a swimming suit until the tide goes out. And the meaning of that is, during the 1929 collapse and so on afterwards, many Ponzi schemes were running. Many illicit investment programs were running, but people kept getting money in, kept getting paid money, and they
got
didn't
paid.
Realize
Must be working.
they didn't realize that it was a fraudulent scheme until we had a downturn. Now, we're going to probably have a recession in 2020 or 2021, probably not bad enough to trigger a lot of these, but we'll see a lot of collapses go on simply because we've gone 10 years without a major economic downturn. And when it comes time, people start demanding their money back.
That's when the Ponzi schemes collapse. That's how Madoff got caught,
yeah,
who just this week applied to the president for a shorter term on his sentence.
Well, he's only got 150 years to serve.
Yeah, he's 81 years old, and he's requesting a shorter term. I think I'd say sure, give him 75 years. That's fine.
Yeah, give him another 75 years and credit him with time served. Give him 75 years.
We cut 75 off, so here you go. Good job, guy.
Cut his sentence in half. It's still a life sentence.
He's, as far as I'm concerned, he needs to be in there for life.
The point is that just be aware that there are no secret insider deals. If you don't believe that, all you have to do is do a little research into hedge funds, which had these tremendous supposed returns for a while and now have, for the past several years, underperformed the market, even the ones that are still surviving. And a majority of hedge funds, I don't know how it is this year, but the majority of hedge funds last year that were in existence went out of existence. And when they go out of existence and they give the money back, they don't give you all your money back. So a lot of people in these hedge funds got back 20 and 30 cents on the dollar that they invested when the hedge fund was shut down. Sure, there are a few that have made tremendous amounts of money in a short period of time, and a relatively small number of people who had tremendous amounts of money and invested in them made a lot of money. But those are the exceptions. Going with plain Jane, low-cost mutual funds, and diversifying correctly, which is a bit of a drill in and of itself, is the only reasonable way to move forward financially and to not take a big risk of losing your money. And there's a lot of this going on. So just be aware that the threat is there. It's there continually. And the person who's most likely to get you into one of these things is somebody who's already a victim and doesn't know it.
All right. Now, this is something I wanted to talk about in the first hour, and I'll probably wrap it up relatively quickly. But it's new currency, the Libra, Facebook's intended thing. I'm not going to delve too deeply into what it is, but I'm going to point out there's a website called www.technologyreview.com. It's MIT Technology Review, and they're looking at Libra, and they're saying, this isn't the traditional cryptocurrency, traditional as if that means anything. They've only been around for a pretty short period of time. This is much more like a private currency that we've seen in earlier eras. And so they do something on a technology site that I give them great kudos for. Andrew Lowe is the head of their economics department. He's not involved in this, but I have had good conversations with him and just completed a certificate program that he participated in, and this looks like the kind of stuff that he's approved, and that is that government-backed currencies rule the world right now, and that's been the case for forever, unless you look back just a few years. And there's this concept that it's always government currencies that have ruled the world. The reality is that bank currencies have ruled the world for a far longer period. And if you look at even the United States dollar, it's regulated by a bank. And if you think back to the 1830s, this is a really great example. There were 12 currencies in the United States at that time. They were all called dollars, but they had different exchange rates with each other. And those mm-hmm. things always fluctuated, just like if you were in what is now the European Union 30 years ago, when you had some marks and you were trying to figure out how many francs they would buy. Well, which franc? Do you mean the Belgian franc? Do you mean the French franc? What are we talking about here? And though each of those rates fluctuated against each other, the banks were backing a currency based on their deposits. And this is a fundamental truth on currencies. Currencies are backed by the credit of the issuer. That is the most important thing that you should underline in every thought when you're thinking cryptocurrency, when you're thinking any currency. What's the credit of the issuer? Who's issuing the currency? And if it's Facebook, that's issuing the currency, and they say we're backing it up with this other stuff, it's still, that currency is still weighted on their credit, their profitability. They may own baskets of currencies, and they're supposed to be buying treasuries from the United States and from the European Union and these different currencies to back it. But the reality is that the exchange rate is going to be a lot different than just that basket of currency. It's very much like an ETF in that sense.
I've looked at Libra and its proposal, and I can't figure out for the life of me why
they're just going with a private bankroll. No,
use PayPal in dollars.
Because the aim for the Libra is to take a step beyond that and get into international trading. And the problem with that is that this is the ultimate wrong turn, the ultimate wrong time to approach building new bridges between the economies of the world, because every single economy on the planet right now is busy knocking down bridges, and they're presenting one made out of toothpicks.
And the issue of having Facebook being the ultimate backer of my currency, unless I lived in Zimbabwe. Now, if I lived in Zimbabwe,
it's good for third world countries.
Libra would be a pretty
trading
good
with
idea.
Each other. Yeah,
and people in Zimbabwe,
because their currency is backed by the credit of Zimbabwe, which
somebody,
is not so great.
Somebody has got to pay them in Libras before this begins to make sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole idea is they're supposed to be either be paid in Libras or make a deposit of their own currency and then get Libras.
And I could see that if I'm in Zimbabwe with 1,000% inflation and I'm able to buy Libras on a given day, at least what I have bought won't depreciate it 1,000% a year. And I can see some value in that. But the question is, setting up a separate currency run by a corporation just makes me...
It's the way they used to do it. We've moved away from it. We're doing a lot of things that we used to do and we've moved away from because they're dangerous. There's a lot of things going on like that. And I think Libra has a very real danger associated with it because of that. So that was it. That's what I wanted to say. I said it's like ETFs. An ETF mutual fund holds stuff inside it too, but it doesn't mean that that's what it's trading for in its value at any point during the day. Your research is important.
I wanted to throw a little quick note out here. I know a lot of our listeners follow economics and they read the Wall Street Journal, things like this. And there's an article in the Wall Street Journal that says durable goods order were up in June. Actually, if you look at the reality of it, the adjustment to May's numbers was a bigger negative than the rise in June's numbers. So if you take the May adjustment plus the June announced numbers, you find out durable goods orders are still down. If you back out the fact that new aircraft orders rose 75% in June, if you back that out of the system, durable goods orders are still down and they're still declining.
Yeah.
So,
and I mean, Boeing is a big hit on the economy right now. The orders on those airplanes.
737 MAX.
Yeah, it's not just the 737s that orders are being hit on, though. A lot of countries buy these airplanes, or major corporations owned by countries. They're stalling or backing out of other deals, too, because the 737 MAX was not a known problem before it became a known problem. So they're saying, are you reliable? That's having a bottom-line impact on the United States. I mean, they make these things out of stuff that already has a tariff on it, so prices have been going up. The Airbuses have been getting extra purchases. So business is moving away from Boeing because the prices are going up and then they have this big scandal. Boeing's big enough that their transactions in the international world appear on our GDP. And we're out of time for this week.
And you've been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. If you'd like to give us a call off the air where you can talk to voicemail on the weekend, live people during the week, it's 254-947-1111. Or
you can go 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Listen to recordings of the radio program going lots back. And till next